Welcome to this episode of the Spinoza Triad with Dr. Richard Miller and myself, John Gibbs. Dan is rather busy at the moment, and no doubt join us for future episodes. Richard and I discuss, for no other reason than it interests us, the Beauty Queen thought experiment.
Well, this is one we talked about I messaged you about. Okay, this is the thought experiment. So it relates a little bit to our discussion of psychopaths, and it's this, and it's the one I sent you, which is that if you had in your hand a vial which contained a virus, a small chemical vial, and you could release it into the world, and it would remove everyone's compulsion to do violence. They'd become very generous, and they'd be peaceful, and they would think good thoughts to their fellow man. And this would spread rapidly. It would be an extremely effective virus, and everyone would catch it in no time at all. It had no other nasty side effects other than abolishing anyone's drive towards violence. So presumably war would stop. And so, well, you wouldn't know this, but you say, well, okay, I have this in my hand. Shall I break the vial and release it into the world?
Right. And is it just violence on the thought experiment, or is it just a general?
It removes the compulsion to do violence. So people become peaceful and generous towards their fellow man. So they think good thoughts. They want to. Yeah, OK, I'll extend it. It produces in people a kind of generosity that makes them want to help their fellow man.
So a goodness.
Yeah, it's like it's the Beauty Queen. When she says, "What do you want for the world? And what do you hope to achieve with your year as the Miss World?" You know, a world peace.
Right.
What I'm after is world peace.
World peace, you know? and general good. I mean, the first problem with anything like that is, I guess, the relative nature of the good. Because I was thinking, we started reading this stuff for, we agreed to do this one on evil. And the first kind of stumbling block I think you come across is a definition, and in I suppose in that thought experiment, if everyone was aimed towards the good, it soon becomes almost relativized and normalized. And what good
in order for
normal.
One to exist, so one value is defined by its absence, by its opposite.
Yeah.
So in the world of good people, we'd simply reframe our idea of what good was.
Yeah.
And even very minor indiscretions, not immediately handing over to the old lady the charity or assisting with someone across the road. Citizen, I saw you hesitate for a moment when that poor old woman was about to cry. And that would be, arrest that man. He didn't deliver his generosity with a sufficient energy.
But that's kind of, you see those shifts, don't you? You know, you do see those shifts, like the current arguments around people being offended. You know, that being offended now is considered far worse than it was 20 years ago. I think in terms of that thought experiment, I think initially, so that's the first problem, is you would normalize what it was. You know, the good would become normalized, or the good or being non-violent. Yeah. What does that then say about any form of resistance? I mean, moving away from evil a little bit here, but any form of sort of artistic, political, you know, youth subcultures, anything like that works in as a resistance against a sort of common strand, doesn't it? You have dominant ideologies and you have resistances to those. So, I mean, let's just pick on one of those examples. Let's say, politics would cease to exist, wouldn't it? I don't mean like a political process, but I mean politics proper, as in a way you organise a society.
Or would politics to that still be there? Because if politics is the trying to resolve things that are material, it's the material finiteness of the world. There isn't an infinite amount of stuff, so we have to solve that in a number of ways, economic or political, the sharing out of resources, the allocation of jobs, the allocation of resources and people's roles within society. They'd all be there. So now we'd approach it with a conviction. All human beings would be convinced of their necessity to play their part in some sort of altruistic way.
Well, you end up with two warring parties that represent the people, each aiming, arguing that they were the
yeah,
most
well,
good.
In other words, yeah. You wouldn't notice any difference. If politics would actually remain completely unchanged, it would be, you'd loathe the opposition party for their lack of goodness in relation to you, and they would loathe you for declaring that they were a lack of goodness.
Yeah, who had the most good? I mean, if we look at that as a kind of a will or a strand or a drive, though, that we're moving somewhat away from that thought experiment with this. But from what I could gather, you know, you read the material. I mean, I sort of broke this down, sort of psychological dimensions to evil, obviously theological ones, psychoanalytic ones, historical examples of evil, pop culture versions of evil, and philosophical problems of evil. And I felt that some of the thinkers, if we start with the sort of philosophy strand here, I think with people like Schopenhauer, Kant, there's a strain there of this idea of some kind of pathology or some kind of will or something to which humanness or subjectivity or however we want to phrase it, that something that makes us are in some respect driven by, you know, some form of drive. And that can either be, like you say, in your thought experiment, a strand of goodness, but though I didn't really find many philosophers that argued for that. Most were kind of that human beings, and it probably has religious overtones. There was a strand of, Kant talks about kind of a pathology, or we're bound to this kind of drive of self-interests and just self-interest and drives. And to be good is an actual ethical act in which you have to step away from that. So if you like evil in that sense, in one form, we're almost bound to
or that form to, of evil anyway. To defeat evil, to defeat the violent impulse, you have to use reason.
And
against yourself. Yeah, master your own drive. Master your own.
But I think you know, and I'm being cautious here, not to step into evil in a kind of ideological sense of a kind of, you know, a devil with a fork or some other, or an actual act as such. Because I think Kant's quite clever in what he does there is when he looks at, you know, his ethics is an ethics of motivation, isn't it? The ontological ethics. It's an ethics that you're looking at rather than the outcome of an action, the actual ethical act itself. It's something is defined as ethical to the moral law, but the moral law can have no content. So it doesn't exist of any actual command other than a fidelity or staying loyal to your duty, whatever it
so
may
the,
be.
The ethical so, act, the good act, is good in all circumstances, regardless of outcome. It's internally good.
It's a moral law, yeah. It's good. It's the only, the will,
it's
the will is the only
imperative.
Thing.
You can't escape.
Will is the
going
only
back
thing
to the
good
thought experiment. If you were to say, well, what would Kant say about a thing like that? You say, well, what you'd remove people's reason. You'd simply turn them into automata. What you've done with your virus was make us less than human. I'm guessing. I don't know. Yeah, so Kant, what would you say about this? But I'm guessing that would be the case. The one objection to releasing the virus would be that you haven't actually cured. You haven't got rid of evil as an external thing. You may have redefined, the society may carry on just as normal. Politics will be just as difficult. You may redefine your parameters around evil and so on. But also, even if you did then walk through society and it was like the Truman Show and everyone's sort of waving at each other and saying, morning, citizen, how are you? You've not left any human ability to people to derive any sense of good out of it. You've simply suppressed a characteristic of humans. So you, for instance, you might say, well, in that case, since you can't have this virus, why don't we simply, cut people's hands off or something? I mean, we'd sort of manage,
right,
but we wouldn't be able to commit so much violence. It'd be better if we're all handless, live in a poorer world, but we'd live in a less dangerous world.
I guess the interesting thing with these kinds of arguments where things really, I mean, I guess it's not, I was going to say that would end up an extremely repressed society, but there's nothing to be repressed, is there? Because everyone's sort of zombified towards being good. Sounds pretty boring.
It's what we were saying the other day, I think, when we talked about what.
No more UFC at the weekend either.
Yeah, I can't imagine there'd be much MMA fighting. You know, they'd just get in the ring there. And, I'm sorry, I really don't want to hurt you. No, obviously, want to.
Yeah, yeah. No, nobody want to watch.
Nobody want to watch this stuff. You know, oh,
the Canadians would lose ice hockey. There'd be no, yeah, the or American football. I mean, all of these things are extremely violent, aren't they? Within
what
confines,
about
isn't
the world
it?
Then, if we're thinking, well, actually, a bit of violence is not bad now and again. Human aggression. We seem to be saying that it's actually a good thing. I mean, that it's almost doubling back to our psychopaths thing, that they are somehow the grit in the oyster, the thing that drives society forward, or something like that. That human aggression and violence and war, in fact. I mean, you hear that argument. People say, oh, wars are quite good, really. You know, after wars, you get shake-ups of social frameworks, you get inventions, you get great creativity. And even at its most brutal, it gets rid of some of the surplus population.
I'm never too sure of those arguments, but I mean, it's... I think what that does for me is just highlight the problem of definition of evil, and the kind of a lot of these philosophical models exist in a kind of a priori kind of understanding of what this human subject, if you like, is first. So, you know, whether, you know, are we chained to some sort of pathology, or is, you know, are we a kind of split subject where we've got on the one hand these sort of drives, if you like, or these motivations, incentives, and then on the other the rational free choice to either follow them or not, you know, not a rational choice, just to go regardless with them. I think that's Kant's point, really. That's where he has a term, radical evil, and radical evil is kind of not a judgment on an outcome or act. It's just a straying from the moral path itself. So I think Zizek, you used this example of three levels of evil. One is to know your duty, but you can't discipline yourself to it. So you remember, this is Kant. So we're talking about the moral law is a fidelity or a loyalty to your duty. So at the first level, he argues that Kant's talking about that you know your duty, but you can't discipline yourself to your duty. And that's at the first level. And I think that's quite a common kind of theme, isn't it? People know they shouldn't be doing stuff or what's right and what's wrong, but they think, you know, I just can't get the discipline to do the right thing. Like, it's just easier for me to do, you know, X, Y, Z. The second one's quite interesting here. Acts as if in accordance with duty, but motivated by some pathology. So an example, a teacher. So a teacher acts as if disciplining the student were for the good of the student, but are really fueled by some sort of impulse, sadist or sadistic. Most institutional settings, you can kind of get that. You could, don't you? You get this person that takes the rules a little bit too far, or the enjoyment is within that. And I think that's kind of the territory by which you might find radical evil situated broadly within that, because it would be on the motivations or inclinations of the individual. Number three, he says, rejects the rules, seen as an imposition and a restraint. And I think, like, when we talked about psychopaths or sociopaths, perhaps, you know, that you sort of Joker character in Batman as an imposition but restraint. But the fourth one is diabolical evil, which Kant refuses to think human beings or human subjects could do. And that's exactly the same as the moral law, because remember, the moral law or the ethical act can have no content. So diabolical evil is elevated to the level of that. And he doesn't think that that's something that no one would elevate evil to that level, but theoretically it's exactly the same. It's a contentless thing at the highest level. There's a kind of twist in there as well, though, because in imposing that as a law, as an injunction to follow whatever it would be, you're kind of making a content for the law in itself. I don't think it can ever be sort of achieved. For anyone watching, these arguments in Kant come on his Religion Within the Limits of Reason Alone. It's sometimes seen as a kind of outlier to Kant's other three major texts. And if anyone has ever tried to read Kant in here, it's heavy going, isn't it?
Well, yeah, and Kant has this annoying habit of using words in his own way. That distinction between a kind of ultimate kind of evil, I mean, I guess us, we human beings, and when you think about evil, you make a very early distinction in human response to evil between natural evil and human-made evil. So right. There's the sort of earthquakes and so on. I mean, there's an earthquake at the moment in Turkey, a terrible earthquake.
Yeah.
And you think to yourself, as the people are dug out of the rubble and people shout, God is great, I can't help thinking, well, why don't they question whether God should have made this thing? I mean, I don't, the appropriate time to I won't approach anyone ask them that question.
Yeah.
But God allows earthquakes. Earthquakes, are they simply evil or simply events in the world? What purpose do they play in this fallen world, and so on? So that leads you on to it. You could go down the direction of doubt. Why does God allow earthquakes? Or you could make the distinction between natural and man-made evil. And then you say, well, but human beings are natural. We're driven by nature just as much as any earthquake is, in a sense, especially if you believe some sort of physical determinism. So in that sense, they're all evil. You can't even make that distinction very easily. Since the psychopath or the very evil person or Adolf Hitler or whatever are doing what their nature drives them to do. You know, the scorpion on the back of the frog. The frog swimming across the river, you know, we talked this before, the frog swimming across the river, the scorpion stings him, and the frog says, well, both going to drown now. And the scorpion says, well, yeah, but I'm a scorpion. You know, that's what I do.
Yeah.
So in that sense, the evil person is part of nature. Human evil is part of nature. So there is even that early distinction. Is
do you not think though? This first off, I don't know if a disaster or is it on the same level as it can be a tragedy, but not necessarily evil. To me, evil is some kind of it is difficult to define outside of ideology. It's an act, isn't it? It's carried out and it's motivated by something. It's not necessarily an outcome. This is why I thought Kant was interesting here, because I don't think he answers the question in any straightforward sense. It's extremely difficult. I mean, my takeaway from his argument, to summarize, would be that human beings are chained to pathological sort of motivations, which, if left to our own devices, are self-serving, and we act out of our own interests. The ethical act to do something to break from that is an act that totally reconfigures you. You know, it's something in you. And we can talk about that in more depth a bit later, because there's some kind of interesting kind of problems that he mentions that come about that. But if we go back to what you're describing now, I would call an earthquake a tragedy, and it's awful, but it's not necessarily evil. I think you bring up a good point there when you say about evil in the world and the relationship to God.
There's an argument that the classical world didn't have much of a concept of evil. They had a concept of not behaving well, or the absence of good, or not living the virtuous life, and so on. But so that one suggestion is that Christianity itself invents evil, or the definition of bad things. And a very early distinction they have to make is between clearly a lion eating a baby antelope.
Yeah.
Is not evil, and yet some human being eating a baby is evil, and that's so making a distinction that only human beings seem to be capable of evil.
Yeah,
and that earthquakes and thunderstorms and lions aren't evil at all. That is the natural world.
Yeah.
That still leaves you asking, well, why do they exist? Because in Christian theology, there's a world where those things themselves don't exist. The Garden of Eden, in the beginning, as it were, human beings exist. Even if you take that as a metaphor for what's possible, then why isn't the world perfect?
Isn't that a bit like your thought experiment? The Garden of Eden before the fall, that is kind of the world you're describing after your vial has been released, isn't it? You know, it's everything's good, isn't it?
And what was it like? What was day-to-day life like in the Garden of Eden? Well, it's very, you know, we might go back again and say, well, they're dull, actually.
A
lot of wandering around stark naked without any knowledge of, and then of course what was the attraction of Eve to the apple? The attraction of the apple is the apple of knowledge, and the knowledge reveals good and evil, and you know, or Pandora's box, out into the world comes evil, or comes at least the knowledge of evil. With the knowledge of evil, then you are into the world. Well, in that case, then Eve is far from being someone who's led to the fall and the great original sin, was necessary to begin human beings on this journey. So one early theological kind of answer to the, well, there are two theological answers to the, to, there are probably more theological answers than two, but two I can think of right away.
Yeah,
is that one, you need evil in the world, or bad things, earthquakes and so on, but you need human evil in the world, well, not the earthquakes, but the bad things that humans do, in order to provide free will.
Yeah.
In other words, human beings have a choice. You couldn't have a choice if there were good and evil. So, for instance, if you release that virus, you take away everyone's choice to be bad.
Yeah.
And you may say, well, you can't really. That's an unethical act for you to release that virus, because No one chose to be infected by it.
Yeah.
You chose them. You made an ethical choice on everyone's behalf. He said, well, I'd rather much more other people were peaceful and altruistic and nice. But they didn't choose to do it. So you could release the virus if you said, well, it's now not a virus, not a vial that infectious, but in fact something people choose. Would you like to be injected with this thing that will make you more peaceful and take away your violent impulses? That's all right. But not you choosing it for other people, because the essence of the world, an essence of being human, is to choose.
Yeah.
So there's the free will argument. And the second argument is the sort of veil of souls argument. That this world is a fallen world through which you pass to something else. You're only seeing the tip of the iceberg. You know, reality is far greater than you can imagine. God is far more mysterious than you can imagine. And in this little world of ours, you're passing through. Your soul is being burnished. You know, it's being refined. And some of you will make it, and some of you won't.
Right.
and some of you might need a few goes if you believe in reincarnation. But essentially, this world is a way in which the imperfect humans are tested against the temptations of evil.
In that latter one, you've almost platonic. You've got the kind of idealized version of what the world, you know, is in long term, and we're just here.
Yeah, well, I think Platonism fits neatly in with early Christianity because it suggests there is a good.
Yeah.
And that good can become God, and there is a thing that's definably really good externally to us. If you can discover through reason an objective truth which is true in all circumstances, okay, there's no metaphysical quality to it in that sense. It's purely derived by human reason, but it's still.
But he won't say what it is. There's no actual kind of the ideal is the motivating choice, isn't it? As opposed to, I mean, just quickly on something you just said there was on the, you know, we went back to when Eve has the apple and the split, if you like, because I find that really interesting, because when we started this, I thought, you know, you started off with that thought experiment. I didn't quite know where to start a talk like this on, but there's a massive problem with definition of evil, to define it. The idea there that, you know, I like what you were saying there, you know, she bites the apple, it gives us the tree of knowledge. And then we end up with a kind of division there, or a split. And again, the thought experiment shows as well, it's impossible to have any form of a working definition of evil outside of. And the problem with, I think, with a sort of a platonic or an idealist argument of evil is it's very easy to have an extra discursive thing outside of, you know, the stuff of nightmares, or, and it kind of removes the human aspect of it, or it can do, as kind of monsters. I mean, I'm thinking here of like the Hannah Arendt, The Banality of Evil. In that one, she's, for anyone that's not aware of it, she wrote the book about the Eichmann trials, that the Nazi who was the sort of overseer of Auschwitz. And she's written this account of his trial, and she thought it was a new form of evil that was, you know, that was a bureaucratic evil. And the premise is just that it's called the banality, or the nothingness that's there, because this guy that's been responsible for a horrendous amount of deaths, that was just claiming that he was a bureaucrat following orders. I think the strength of that argument is that it's a very materialist response, isn't it? It's not situating, he was just he's a devil, it was an evil kind of that we've not seen. It was an evil that we've not seen before, but it was very materialistic. It was down to very cold choice. And, you know, obviously he makes it as out that he was just following orders, and it was bureaucracy. But
yeah, I think that when you think about what Hannah Arendt is doing with that idea of the banality of evil, is what we're all doing in a way, is coming to terms with the Holocaust and the concentration camps and so on. And is the Holocaust any different to all sorts of evil that's been going on for years? The rack burning people to death and horribly hang drawing and quartering and so on. A lot of, or Stalin's mass murdering of people in Stalin's Russia. And you say, well, it was materially different because of its odd banality, because its bureaucratic efficiency, driven almost by a system of its own momentum.
Yeah.
Not by some belief in that you're going to, you know, I don't know whether Stalin believed much about communist belief or creating a better world. But at least there was an ideological drive behind it. Whereas I think maybe I'm talking myself in a circle, because I know there was something like a Nazi ideology. Though I prefer to think the Nazis are an absence of all ideology, really. They were against things. They were trying to do things. They weren't. I'm not sure what kind of world they were trying to build, but they were trying to build a world without rather than with. Right. It was an absence of the world. So in that sense, and the way it was exercised. So I think Kant couldn't have comprehended, you know, if for Kant something like diabolic, maybe that is diabolical evil. Maybe that's why he doesn't think diabolical evil could exist, is because... Yeah. Evil for Kant is so the willful denial of your duty, either knowingly or foolishly. Well, there's something more than the willful denial of duty in the Nazis. Anyone who's been to Auschwitz and you walk around there, you think to yourself, I think I'm witnessing something beyond almost comprehension. It was like you can't quite understand this. It goes outside rational thought. And the people operating it were so driven by such a sort of, as you say, a banal bureaucratic mechanism.
One of the critiques that's launched at that book sometimes from a psychoanalytic perspective is the one where they argue that she argues that the economy of evil, if you like, we use that word, you know, we've got two opposing parties. So you've got an economy of evil, which is working kind of around a banality of bureaucratic structure. And people engaging with that structure, this is sort of the field by which evil is played out at. Yeah. Now, the psychoanalytic argument is the one of an obscene libidinal supplement to that. So that there is definitely that going on. But at the level of sadist or kind of almost like a perverted libidinal economy, there was a satisfaction and enjoyment in the very bureaucratic practices themselves. So, you know, the smartness of the uniforms, the obsession with bureaucracy. I think, John, was it you were explaining to me that, you know, they would deliberately photograph every single face before everyone that went into the camps.
It's this astonishing level of bureaucracy that was quite, again, quite banal. I mean, the photographing, the fingerprinting, the tattooing people who had only hours to live. I mean, I don't know if they tattooed people who... they kept for a while, but they were essentially these people all doomed, whether they were going to be gassed right away or whether they were going to be worked to death and then gassed later on or whatever. They're all doomed. So why would there? You'd think there would be a much more sort of animalistic brutality. And it seems to me that there's something, yes, that Lacanian idea of of constructing an edifice of symbol to distance you from what you actually don't want to see.
There's that notion of a separation, but I think in actual fact, that's almost reversed here, because I think that the point is that the psychoanalytic work, I mean, that expression jouissance, which translates as enjoyment, but it doesn't mean enjoyment in terms of satisfaction. It means a kind of pleasure in pain. There was a level of, like I say, this obscene libidinal supplement, which is a form of almost, I wouldn't say an eroticization is the right word, but just an obsession with rules, the rituals, the bureaucratic process itself, like you say, the photographing. Just on the one hand, there is the banality of evil in terms of there's a hole there of a nothingness, but really that hole's filled with an obsession for the micro details itself. I don't know any Nazis, and I mean I can only imagine from, you know, what you read or you see, but there does seem to be a kind of some strange kind of obsession with order, papers, with all of this kind of process,
and a pride in doing the thing they're doing well. That's odd. That's odd as well. You know that there's an efficiency in it. They're, you know, meeting targets, drawing graphs of numbers killed, trying to meet monthly quotas. All this odd. You'd think it would be a sort of mayhem of slaughter, wouldn't you? Like a kind of we were talking the other day about the Rwandan genocide, how it was almost a frenzy of hysterical killing.
Yeah,
I mean, I know there's a degree in which people say, well, it must have been planned beforehand and there was an awful lot of underground stuff going on. I can accept all that. But it wasn't systematized.
In response to, like, the contrast, those, because, I mean, both you would have to categorize as evil beyond belief, you know, the Holocaust and then the Rwandan genocide. But on the one hand, we've got a kind of very materialistic account of Eichmann from Arendt's point of view, where you've got evil as a banality. Then you've got the sort of psychoanalytic sort of Zizek, Zhupanishik argument, where in actual fact, where it's, you know, it's a fetishization of the bureaucratic procedures themselves. Again, very materialistic. And you can contrast that with, there's on YouTube, I haven't seen it, must still be on there years ago. It's called The Ghosts of Rwanda. And it starts off with an interview with I think he's Canadian. He was the general, the Ovis that was, what were they called? What were the troops called there? Peacekeepers. That's it. Yeah, he was the general, the major that oversaw that. You know, and the poor guy. I mean, I can you imagine being there when it happened, and they couldn't do anything. That's where that movie Shooting Dogs comes from, because they were allowed to shoot dogs, they couldn't shoot any people, and it lasted 3 months. It was a faster death rate, or high, I'm sure I read this stat. It was a higher death rate than the fastest rate in the Second World War in single days. So it was about 850,000 people killed with machetes primarily over a 12-week period. And he talks on there about, literally, he said it was almost like a mist. I'm sure the word he uses is evil. He goes, you could literally, it was a tangible feeling. There was a wave, this sense of dread that overcame. And, you know, people couldn't think of that what they will, you know. I'm sure everyone will have a different opinion on that. I mean, I do know that I've never been in a situation like that, and I wouldn't ever question a man who had an account of that afterwards. But kind of different view of it, isn't it? It's taking evil as something more than any situation, a kind of like an excess or an extra thing there, almost religious.
You think about the Holocaust, or you think about the Rwandan genocide, or whatever, the first question that comes into anyone's mind, again, a bit like if you think about evil itself, you ask whether God exists and why is it allowed to happen? Why is the world not without these things? Why people made nice? Then when you think of the Holocaust, you think of that, the question that comes into mind is, what would I have done? Are we all capable of this? Are human beings innately violent given the right circumstances? I know we're repeating a little bit of love.
I just want to say as well, John, I'm not in any way suggesting that the Holocaust doesn't have the same unimaginable evil cast over it as well. It's just, you know, philosophically that there were two different ways of looking at something, aren't there? You know,
but also that is a historical and cultural question itself. I mean, there will be those who would argue they're not. You have in the world of Holocausts, and human beings are capable of these sorts of things, and your distinction, or my distinction, which I would make, is that there's something uniquely awful about the German Holocaust and the Second World War. Then again, you may say, well, you know, well, let's unpack that a little bit. The reason you don't like it, the reason you think that's particularly awful, is because you imagine, in a quite post-colonial kind of way, that the Germans should have known better. So where are you going? Yeah. Where are you going with that thought, Gibbs? Because it happened in Africa, in Rwanda, this is somehow more organic and more human, more unrestrained, whereas the creators of Beethoven, you know, the people that listened to opera, should they have done this thing, you know? And you think, or are we simply saying, well, all humanity is? And it's easy to slip into that view that somehow the industrially advanced and educated, highly literate Germans shouldn't have done this for reasons that I really don't want to think about.
Jordan Peterson makes this argument quite a lot, doesn't he? He says that people are capable of, you know, everybody's capable of being a monster. You know, everyone is capable of very bad things. And once you realise that, you can start to deal with it. I mean, I mentioned this the other day. I mean, my mate, he's been to war a few times. And I remember me and him were away and I was chatting to him. I said, I don't think I could do that. You know, shoot someone or whatever it was. He's been to war a number of times, a Bosnian war. And he just said to me, yeah, sure you would. Sure you would. You know, someone walks in, holds a gun up to your family. You've got a gun in your hand. What do you do? You know, he said it's as simple as that. You know, and then it unfolds. And so his point is everybody's capable of very bad things. It's just within what context, I suppose. I mean, what you're saying there, what you're saying there links quite nicely, John, with the sort of psychology arguments with Zimbardo stuff, doesn't it? For those people listening, Zimbardo was a psychologist in the late 60s that did the Stanford prison experiment. And he later on went on to sort of work through various kind of war crime style stuff. But initially what he did was set up a fake prison, fake guards. You know, people came in, they would got, I think it was 14 volunteers. You had guards and you had prisoners. And I mean, it's, now it would be deemed as highly unethical. You wouldn't be able to do it now. But he observed it. And really what happened is people fell into the roles almost straight away. A few did resist, but and they had to shut down the experiment.
But there's two famous psychology experiments, isn't there? That one and the other one whose name I can't remember, which is the
is that Milgram?
Electric shocks, where they convince people that they are experimenters when they're not really, they're being experimented on. So you invite these people in, they give them a white coat, and you say, we're testing human cognition and intelligence, and you ask people questions, and we're seeing if a little bit of pain would help, you know. And they give them the impression that this dial in front of them, this is a little bit of pain down here, and you turn it right up to there, it's a lot of pain, but just give them a little bit, just a little bit of pain. And the person, oh, fair enough. And then at some point, the supervising experimenter who's really in on this, and the person sitting there being delivered the pain to, yeah, is an actor, and they say to them, well, can you give them a bit more pain and a bit more pain, till in the end their mind's writhing in agony and begging them to stop. The experiment unfortunately seems to show, given the right authority, people, ordinary people off the street, will inflict a quite horrifying amount of pain.
So I mean, really, that it does bring in that idea of of self. I guess it's a pathology of self, where it's easy to think of these things in terms of I have the free choice, or you have less free choice perhaps than you think in these sort of situational arguments.
There's that human capacity to abrogate their free choice, isn't there, to others. You know, we have a terrible tendency, it seems, us human beings, to groupthink, to follow someone who appears to be in charge, the crowd who attacks someone.
It's an agentic state. It's a shift from personal autonomy to an agentic state. And the agentic state is one whereby you become basically an agent of whichever state it is that's controlling you. Kind of, isn't that what you're saying there? Is it depending on the sort of institutional and...
Divesting yourself of your personal thing. So why are soldiers put in uniforms? The uniform duty to allow you to easily get rid of your own personal identity and associate yourself with the group.
Zimbardo did that, didn't he? I mean, Zimbardo, it wasn't by accident that the guards wore a certain uniform all the same. They wore mirrored sunglasses, had batons, and the prisoners had to wear whatever they did. It wasn't a lot, I know that. I mean, Zimbardo, at the beginning of that book, separates situational influence. So he says that you've got behavioural contexts, the rewards, the norms, the meanings that give identity. That's the one he has. He said these are kind of the factors, if you think, the influences. So situational influence, he says the person themselves, so the actor, influences there will be genetic, biological, psychological, and physical. You know, we've mentioned about, I mean, I'm not saying he employed psychopaths, but we can broadly say perhaps that there are different personality types. Some would be more inclined for rules and this kind of thing than others. I think Adorno's F scale, where he looked at what was it was a questionnaire Adorno put together, whereby he would see how much somebody would follow rules or follow fascism, basically. So the last one, system. So agents, ideology, values of the system itself. So he puts those three things together and says that would give a context as sort of how malleable people are.
Given the system, you'd hope that you'd be the person who stood against it or whatever. But it does seem to be a worrying feature of you. While you were talking there, it struck me that not only putting people in uniform gives them a sense of group, a sense of identity. They've divorced themselves from their own judgment and their own values. I'm with the group now, and this is what the group are doing, so you know, I will follow that. It, also, the opposite is true with removing people's clothing. You know, talk about the symbolic of clothing, removing people's clothing. One of the first things that happened in concentration camps was they stripped them. And then the naked human being, I read something in the week about an essay by Zizek about this, about how curious paradox between when you render people their most human, we make them most inhuman. So you strip people down to their nakedness, or you treat them as helpless, and the helpless person often doesn't get the kind of sympathy you'd imagine. You know, you think you'd run forward and throw a blanket over someone and care for them if they were naked, but by stripping away their, you take the people from society and turn them into something less than people by stripping them naked, and therefore it's easier to kill them. It's easier to think of them as not proper human beings, just a thing. By stripping their humanity away, by making them at their most human, is us when we've got no clothes on.
I mean, I guess that works at a discursive, like I know the Rwanda genocide. I think that they had the code word, wasn't it, like chop down the tall trees or something, and referring to them as sort of parasitic, and that dehumanizing process happens, like you say, symbolically through clothing, but also symbolically through language as well, the way in which groups are spoken about, hordes of people trying to get into somewhere. And I mean, there's an ideological dimension there as well. I mean, you mentioned that one there, John. You're talking about the Germans, you know, is there, you know, where are you going with this? Because was it because they were seen as German? I mean, European, as opposed to sort of an orientalist position, whereby you assume that other parts of the world are just other over there. The very idea of ideology itself being a narrative or story that has to, in some sense, overcome something. So, I mean, the immediate examples, let's say Nazis, you know, the Nazi ideology. Well, the narrative was one of a kind of master race, wasn't it? There was some, like you say, it was a stripping away on the one hand, but there was a fictitious return, some Greco-Roman kind of history that didn't really exist, did it? This kind of, like, you know, it's been going for thousands of years, this white superior kind of thing. And in order, and this is the crucial part, I think, in order to get to where we need to be, we need to eradicate this group or that group. You know, there's always that blockage, if you like, to the ideology functioning. You see it everywhere, don't you? I mean, the UK was awful for it, the press, you know, the Brexit votes, you know, we can stop people coming in here, taking our jobs, stealing this. Before Brexit, it was, I mean, I remember when I was younger, it was single mothers. The government had a big thing about, you know, it's single mothers and the way in which it's a breakdown of society. And there's always something to blame to get past. You can't achieve, the ideological fantasy doesn't exist without something that's going to stop it.
Sort of symbolic opposite that, yeah, you have to get rid of before you can get to wherever it is you're getting to, before only this were out of the way. Human beings, we have a tendency to allow human beings to fulfill that role of the block, the obstacle, very, very easily. That we would live in a much more peaceful world if it weren't for these people. A better society would be so much better if it weren't for these people. And this is the, you know, again, I'm reaching into my misunderstanding of sociology here, but something along the folk devils, you know, folk devils and panics and so on. The kind of idea that you conjure up these things in order that you can unify against the threat, and also, and it simplifies. It's a lovely simplification of things that are complex can be simplified down to it's them.
I mean, those two books were interesting because I think in point to what you were saying earlier. With, I mean, first off, that was it the folk devils? Was that the one with the subculture, the mods and the rockers? And he looks at, I really, that form of violence is the resistance of the youth against the dominant conservative, or whatever the dominant political body will be at the time. And it's essential, really, isn't it? I mean, it's where we are, art, music, it's always in form, well, it's not always, but very often in form of resistance against the dominant ideology, which is in control at any one time. Well, let's say dominant ideology, yeah, the dominant viewpoints of the older people who are in control. You know, you need that tension, don't you, to exist. So
absolutely. I often used to ask myself as why are students in many secondary schools so resistant to their experience? And I think to myself, well, partly there were sorts of answers to that probably, but partly it was that's what they're supposed to be doing at that age. In a sense, a school is a place that looks forward and looks backwards. It's trying to say, this is how we do things, and this is how you should behave politely and respectfully, yeah, and learn these skills so you can be this kind of person in society. On the other hand, you at the same time you teach those kids, but you must question that critical thinking. You must be resistant to those things. You're going to live in a world that we don't yet understand. So naturally enough, there's a sort of fault line of psychic tension. Psychic? Is it psychological tension? Emotional tension between students who are supposed to be of the future and of the past at the same time. Therefore, the student in school has to question, why do we wear those stupid uniforms? And why? I'm gonna transgress against that, naturally enough. And so out there in wider society, resistance to the way things are is, well, we would probably think of it as natural, wouldn't we? So going back to our thought experiment, you know, take out the old virus, goes out, and everyone goes, oh, this is the best of all possible worlds. Lovely, this is. You might say, oh, no, I don't want that.
Yeah, yeah. You know this Alan Badiou book, Ethics, An Essay on the Understanding of Evil? It's a great little text. I really recommend if anyone was interested in reading it. I mean, Badiou's kind of main thing is the creation of events. So you have an event that occurs historically or whenever, you know, 9/11 would be an event, or you have anything could be an event, and we are made subjects to that event. We become subjects to it, and we have a truth or a fidelity to the event. There's quite strong strands of Kant running through his stuff. But the bits on evil really is his premise is that really all forms of ethical model, when we try and do good or try and do the right ethical model, results in evil. So evil, if you like, is something which comes off of an attempt to arrive at the good.
Well, we did step on that. We did say a little bit about that in the last podcast on psychopaths, where I think, you know, when people like Himmler or Eichmann said they were good Kantians, because they or have been described as such, because they're or the figure of the psychopath Segura in the film No Country for Old Men is fidelity to a moral code, and it's the Frankfurt School, those professors and philosophers and cultural writers and so on who associated with the Frankfurt University, who came to the United States fleeing the Nazis after the Second World War, with a mixture of Marxist ideology, criticism of capitalism, and their own understanding of what fascism was, their response to contemporary culture said, well, one of the things they said was, you know, people like Adorno and Horkheimer, they said that you can see the origins of Nazism in the Enlightenment rationalism and utilitarianism, that, you know, it produces fidelity to the attempt to perfect mankind, leads you by a series of good intentions down to the concentration camps. You could say, well, the Nazis at its maddest, most evil and monstrous was an attempt to perfect mankind. And yet in its own little way, when I go into an education institution, or when you think about what we're trying to do in society, aren't we trying to perfect mankind? If you said, I won't break that vial open and release the virus, then what are you saying? You don't think men are perfect, human beings are perfect. You wouldn't want a perfectible world. Aren't we trying to produce a world of peace and tranquility and order? If we're not, then we're just what we are then.
But I mean, that implies that peace, and when I say peace, but tranquility doesn't come at some cost or doesn't come at some sort of struggle. Because I don't think, you know, you can't compare a genocide to, I don't know, some sort of uprising somewhere where you've got, again, I think it's the motivation that changes, isn't it, that's different.
The problem with that is, if we could have the heaven on earth, if the kingdom of heaven could be created on earth, then you remove, presumably, all forms of evil and all forms of violence, we are all good, righteous men and women, then what's the purpose of God after that? Or is indeed that what the purpose is? You know, the war against yourself is the war to overcome your ghastly, human, nasty, animalistic tendencies. And that's where all this horrible stuff comes from, violence and so on. We are basically animals. But if we overcome it, then what then? Is that the purpose then? Is basically the defeat of mankind. You have been listening to another episode of the Spinoza Triad, which this week was a discussion between Dr. Richard Miller and myself, John Gibbs. We talked about evil, we talked about the beauty queen thought experiment, and wondered what a world that was free of all violence might actually be like. If you enjoyed our discussion, if you'd like to suggest ideas for future discussions, link to our Facebook group, The Spinoza Triad, or post your suggestions on our website. Thank you for listening.